On Wednesday, 2nd of November 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of students on the occasion of National Students' Day and the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated in Iran both on the 4th of November each year. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Of November in the Islamic Republic of Iran has been designated as the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance. It is also Students' Day in Iran, and on Wednesday, 2nd of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with a large group of hundreds of students who sang a beautiful song for their leader. At this meeting, on Wednesday, 2nd of November 2022, Artin Serai Daran was the special guest of the leader. The mournful young child had lost three members of his family in the recent terrorist attack on Shah Cheragh in the city of Shiraz in southern Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei started off by saying, "The first topic I want to talk about is 4th of November. Well, you have heard a lot about it. 4th of November is a historic day. It is both historic and educational. When we say it is a historic day, it means that on this day there were events that will be recorded forever in our history. These events cannot be forgotten, and they certainly should not be forgotten. They are educational, because there have been reactions as a result of these events that serve as a lesson for us all." The leader poignantly added, "This day is an important day for us. But it also really agitates the Americans. This is a day that frustrates the Americans whenever it is commemorated. This meeting today angers the Americans. They will be agitated by it. But why? Because this day symbolizes the evil and pernicious influence of the United States, and also is a symbol of American defeat. 4th of November proves that the Americans can be defeated." Knowing the enemy and the United States in particular tends to be a recurring theme in Ayatollah Khamenei's comments and remarks. From the point of view of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, the disagreements between Iran and the United States are deeply rooted and fundamental. From the leader's point of view, there is a huge gulf, a huge chasm, between US and Iranian politics and diplomacy, between US and Iranian beliefs, points of view, and historical experiences. The leader continued by saying, "Three historic events took place on 4th of November, some of which are directly related to the Americans, and others are indirectly related. One event was the exile of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, which took place on 4th of November 1964. Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by direct orders of the Shah, and the parliament of those days rubber-stamped this law. According to that law, the Americans who lived in Iran were granted immunity from legal prosecution. According to this law, if an American national committed any sort of crime in Iran, they could not be legally prosecuted. So, for example, if an American happened to run someone over while driving a car, the judicial system in Iran had no right to prosecute them. Imam Khomeini did not tolerate this, of course. He gave a long speech. His voice recording and a text of his speech are available today. Because of this, he was sent into exile. This was an event that was directly related to the Americans. The second event on 4th of November was the killing of students. A number of children who were around your age were massacred, martyred in front of Tehran University. This sad event also took place on 4th of November 1978, just a few months before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The third event, which took place exactly a year later, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, was the students' takeover of the American embassy in Tehran, what became known as a den of espionage. During that attack, many documents were found that revealed the United States' conspiracies against the Iranian nation. These documents show what the Americans were doing during the time they were in Iran, that is, from around 1949 or 1950 onwards. It shows their conspiracies and their acts of treason against the Iranian nation. Further comments, the leader referred to the American and British-backed coup d'etat of August of 1953. On 19th of August 1953, a national government was at work. Mohammad Mossadegh's government was a national government, and the issue he had with the West was about oil. Mossadegh was neither a cleric, nor did he claim to want Islam. It was just about oil. The country's oil was in the hands of the British. He said, "Our oil needs to be nationalized. We have to control our own oil resources." That was his only crime. The Americans staged a coup d'etat, a very bizarre coup d'etat. There are some vague things about that event in my mind. I was 14 years old at the time. I have read the history behind it, and I'm aware of the details. The Americans sat and conspired against Mossadegh and crafted a coup d'etat. Even though Mossadegh trusted the Americans, he trusted them, he even liked them. He thought that the US government would support him against the British, but they actually stabbed him in the back. Turning to the topic of US conspiracies and plots against Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei asked rhetorically, "Is there anything that you had the ability to do against the Iranian nation in the past four decades and that you haven't done? Whatever they didn't do was because they weren't able to do it, or because it didn't benefit them. They did whatever they were capable of doing. They supported separatist groups at the beginning of the revolution. They supported the coup d'etat attempt at Nojeh military base in Hamedan province. The Americans showed support for the blind terrorism of the Munafiqeen, the MKO terrorists, which led to the killing of thousands of martyrs across the nation. They supported the savage Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the eight-year imposed war on Iran. They provided Saddam with weapons, intelligence information, and aid. The war was provoked by the Americans, and they were the ones who forced Saddam to initiate the eight-year war. The Americans shot down an Iranian passenger plane, a commercial airliner, over the skies of the Persian Gulf, which resulted in the death of over 300 innocent Iranians. And they did not express any regret or apologies afterwards. They even rewarded that criminal general who shot down the Iranian commercial plane. They honored him with a medal. This is how you have treated the Iranian people. You imposed sanctions on the Iranian nation since the first year of the Islamic Revolution. You imposed the most severe sanctions that history has ever witnessed in the last few years. They admitted this themselves. They also tried to fuel unrest and sedition in Iran. They fully supported the seditionists during the unrest of 2009. Prior to that, Barack Obama wrote to me saying the US wants to cooperate with Iran. Obama was in a sense swearing that they did not wish to overthrow us. However, as soon as the sedition of 2009 began, they started to support it, in the hope that the sedition might go somewhere and bring the Iranian nation to its knees. They wanted to overthrow the Islamic Republic. This is how you treated the Iranian nation. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution referred to America's assassination of the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. The leader said, "You Americans openly declared that you killed our fearless general. You murdered him, and you were proud of it, and you announced that you gave the orders." Marta Soleimani was not just a national hero, he was a regional hero. Marta Soleimani played a major and unparalleled role in solving the problems of several countries in this region. "You martyred this great man and his companions, Marta Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes and several others. You supported the Zionists, the Israeli regime, which assassinated our nuclear scientists. The Israeli regime martyred our scientists one by one, and you supported them. Not only did you fail to condemn them, but you actually supported them. You have frozen billions of dollars of the Iranian nation's assets in the United States and in other countries. If this money was at the disposal of the hard-working Iranian government, like the current government, it would be able to do great things with it. But you have frozen these assets and you're keeping them. This excludes the assets that were frozen in the United States since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution. America's fingerprints can be seen in most anti-Iranian events, and they claim that they empathize with the Iranian nation." They said this again yesterday, that they sympathize with the Iranian nation. They are, of course, lying. This is complete insolence. Of course, they have shown great hostility towards us, but the Iranian nation, getting the better of them, has thwarted many of these hostilities. Some of these events are still with us. We have not forgotten them. We will never forget the martyrdom of the great general Qasem Soleimani. They know this. We have said some things about this, and we stand by our word. Well, the America of today is the same America of yesterday. The America of today is the same America of August of 1953. It is the same America that helped the Iraqi dictator Saddam. It is the same America of the past few years, with one or two important differences which we must pay attention to. First of all, the enemy's tactics have become more complex. We need to pay attention to this. The hostilities remain the same, but the method of applying these enmities is different and more complex. It is not easy to untie the knots. You need to pay attention. You need to be alert. Of course, we trust our own children, our own youth, and our own officials. We know they're capable of dealing with things that are complicated, but it is complex. This is one difference. Secondly, that day in August of 1953, and even until the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the US was the dominant power in the world, but that is not the case today. This is one important difference. Today, the United States is not the world's dominant power. Many of the world's political analysts believe that the US is declining. It is gradually fading away. We aren't the only ones to say this, of course. We have the same opinion, but the world's political analysts are also saying it. The signs are evident. The United States' domestic problems are unprecedented in the economic, social, and moral spheres, as well as their internal conflicts and the bloodstained divisions inside the country. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution said, "One of the things that I'm saying this now, and some other people across the world have also said it, I believe that one of the signs of Americans' decline is the election of people like the current and former President of the United States. A country of 300 million plus people, almost destroys itself and elects a president in the previous term, somebody like Donald Trump, whom the world considers to be crazy. And after he was defeated, a man like this current president comes to power. And well, you know the stories about him. This is evidence of the decline of a nation. This is evidence of the decline of a civilization. So, this really matters, and it is related to America." The United States also played an obvious role in the recent riots that took place in our country in the past few weeks. The announcement made by Iran's intelligence ministry and the IRGC intelligence organization is a very important announcement. In concluding remarks at the end of his speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution talked about Iran's role in the new world order. The leader said, "What is Iran's role in this new order? Where will Iran be placed? What position will our dear country hold? This is the thing that you need to think about. This is what you need to prepare yourselves for. This is the thing that the Iranian youth can work on. We can have an outstanding position in this new world order. We really can. Why? Because our country has outstanding features that many other countries lack. First of all, we have very talented human resources. We have really good human resources. The intelligence and talent of young Iranians is higher than average intelligence and talent the world over. Today, we are seeing the outcomes of intelligence and talents of those who were born in the 1980s and 1990s. The young people and those who are making innovations and updates in various scientific and technological fields are allowing the country to rank among the top 4 or 5 in the world in a number of disciplines. These are the same people who were born in the 1980s and the 1990s. Their effort is really bearing fruit today."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sirens going off in South Korea. Another salvo of North Korean ballistic missiles fired. This is part of Pyongyang's testing blitz. A new annual record for missile launches was set back in June. And just this week, 23 missiles were launched in a single day, setting a new daily record. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any time. Let's not forget, these missiles have the ability to reach U.S. soil, specifically California. Meanwhile, Washington and Seoul have conducted their biggest ever Air Force drills. North Korea's firing of intercontinental ballistic missiles and more U.S. war games. A dangerous and volatile concoction, a war scenario which, if it were true, would involve nuclear weapons. That was evident from the U.S. side when the U.S. Air Force deployed the 2 B-1B long-range heavy bombers on the final day of the military exercises. This was the first time B-1Bs have flown to the Korean Peninsula since December 2017. So why is Pyongyang on the offensive? Even though the missile launches grabbed all the attention, less notice were developments in the North Korean nuclear doctrine. In September, North Korea updated a 2013 law setting out its nuclear weapons policies and announced that it would respond to attacks against its nuclear command and control systems by launching a nuclear strike automatically and immediately.
"The fundamental mission of our nuclear forces is to deter a war. But our nukes can never be confined to the single mission of war deterrent, even at a time when a situation we are not desirous of at all is created on this land."
The U.S. and its allies in this region better be careful. Even an accidental targeting of anything in North Korea could signal a dangerous reaction. And that could spell nuclear Armageddon. North Korea's barrage of missiles is sending the U.S. another message other than military and missile capabilities. North Korea has been under severe U.S. sanctions. For starters, it has sanctioned properties and belongings of the Workers' Party of Korea freezing the property of members of the Workers' Party of Korea, essentially amounts to stealing from everyday Koreans, as the party's membership stands at 6.5 million people, or a quarter of North Korea's population. Harsh U.S. bilateral and U.N. sanctions have had particularly devastating effects on the North Korean economy. The list of industries directly targeted include the mineral trade, seafood, textiles, and agricultural products. Previous talks between the U.S. and North Korea hinged on the elimination of these sanctions, in return for Pyongyang to stop its ballistic nuclear program. But the U.S. was not willing to give any concessions, resulting in a stalemate. Meanwhile, the U.S. believes that China and Russia have the leverage to persuade North Korea not to resume nuclear bomb testing. But why should they do that, given the Ukraine conflict and how U.S. feels about Russia and U.S.'s appetite for confrontation with China, either militarily or when it comes to trade? This idea seems far-fetched. Perhaps a grand bargain can be reached between the U.S., Russia, and China when it comes to North Korea, if the desire is there before it is too late. And as far as U.S. foreign policy goes, it has failed in many respects. When it comes to countries like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, Syria, well, the list is long. The current U.S. President Joe Biden, like many of his predecessors, has failed to execute a clear diplomatic path to reach solutions, opting for provocation and military aggression.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan held high-level talks in Tehran following a trilateral meeting with Russian and Azerbaijani leaders on the conflict in the Caucasus region. He was officially received by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi on Tuesday morning, and the two held talks at the Sarabot Palace in the capital, Tehran. In addition to a bilateral meeting, the two top executive officials held a meeting of high-level delegations, and after attending the signing ceremony of a cooperation document in the field of energy, they elaborated on the results of their consultations in a joint press conference. The Iranian president stated that Pashinyan's visit to Iran will be a turning point in the development of ties between the two neighboring countries.
Neighborhood policy is one of the policies emphasized by the government, and during this administration we had several meetings with Mr. Pashinyan. In these meetings, especially in this particular meeting, the focus of the negotiations was the development of commercial, economic, and security relations between the two countries.
Expressing satisfaction with the growing trends of relations between the two countries, Raisi pointed to the diverse and numerous capacities available in Iran and Armenia, calling for an all-out effort to improve the level of relations and expand bilateral cooperation. The Iranian president pointed to energy cooperation as one of the capacities available to improve the level of relations between the two countries, saying, "The Islamic Republic is ready to expand cooperation in other economic and commercial areas, including in increasing the export of technical and engineering services." Also noting that the Caucasus region is a part of Iran's history, civilization, and culture, Raisi underscored that security and peace in the Caucasus region are very important for Iran. The Iranian president added that negotiations with Pashinyan led to the conclusion that resolving the issues of the region must occur at the hands of officials and authorities of the region, and any interference by foreigners will only create problems rather than solve them. Pashinyan, for his part, appreciated the constructive role of the Islamic Republic in the region and stressed that Iran's efforts have always been aimed at stabilizing and strengthening peace and security in the region. Pashinyan expressed gratitude for the priority given by Raisi's administration to the development of ties with the neighboring countries. The Armenian premier also called for strengthening transit cooperation between the two countries to connect the Black Sea to the Persian Gulf. Iran opened a consulate in the southern Armenian city of Kapan on October 21st, nearly a year after expressing interest in doing so. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian officially inaugurated the consulate. At the opening ceremony, Amir Abdollahian stated that the security of Armenia and the region is Iran's security. He called for the development of north-south transportation corridor through Armenia. He also said Tehran's policies to respect territorial integrity as well as internationally recognized borders. Tehran had previously stated that changes in its borders and transit links with Armenia would be a red line that it would not tolerate being crossed. That's when Turkey and Azerbaijan have been planning to establish a new transport link, called the Zangzur Corridor. In case of opening, it will affect Iran-Armenia commerce and could sever a major Iranian transit link with the South Caucasus. Meanwhile, Tehran has not contented itself with only diplomatic messages. The inauguration of the Kapan Consulate came after several days of large-scale military exercises by IRGC near Iran's borders with Azerbaijan. The latest simultaneous diplomatic and defensive moves clearly show the Iranian government is ready to defend its national interests in all seriousness.
The United States is under fire for its efforts to influence cyberspace in the country. That's according to a controversial report by The Intercept, which is based on leaked internal memos, emails, and documents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The work is primarily done by Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is a DHS sub-agency tasked with protecting critical national infrastructure. The report says the U.S. government has pressured social media platforms to, quote, shape online discourse. The platforms include Twitter and Facebook. The department has justified this pressure on social media platforms by claiming that it wants to fight, quote, disinformation. The plan stemmed from concerns around alleged Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. It also began to take shape during the 2020 election and over efforts to shape discussions around vaccine policy during the coronavirus pandemic. But how disinformation is defined by the government has not been clearly articulated. There are now concerns that the inherently subjective nature of what could be classified as disinformation will give officials in the Department of Homeland Security a broad opening to make politically motivated determinations about what constitutes dangerous speech. This is while critics say the extent to which the DHS initiatives affect Americans' daily social feeds is unclear.
We must rethink our approach to cybersecurity. Releasing alerts, deploying incident response teams, sharing best practices are important tools. But as the pace and scale of cyber threats that we face expands, so must our response toolkit. We need sustained investment to modernize and protect our most critical federal systems, as well as state and local governments, suffering under budget constraints and increasingly aggressive ransomware operators.
The CISA's domain has gradually expanded to encompass more subjects it believes amount to critical infrastructure. Some believe CISA's goal is to make platforms more responsive to their demands. There are suggestions circulating inside the agency calling for an expansive role for the agency in, quote, shaping the information ecosystem. There are also calls within the agency to closely monitor social media platforms of all sizes, mainstream media, cable news, hyperpartisan media, talk radio, and other online resources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the legislative and executive branch officials are using social media companies to engage in censorship by surrogate. But the growing authoritarian acts by the DHS and the FBI to monitor Americans have raised alarm among civil rights activists. They say the authoritarian nature of such acts are contrary to the U.S. Privacy Act of 1974, which was legislated after the Watergate scandal that led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. The act prohibits state data collection of Americans exercising their First Amendment rights. Critics also say there are no specific legal constraints on the FBI's use of social media. Recently, Snowden sounded the alarm again, warning that the U.S. was expanding its mass espionage activities both inside the U.S. and outside the country.
Iran is remembering a historic day which has come to define its modern history. The day which has been named the Day of Fighting Imperialism falls on the 13th of Aban in the Persian calendar. It is symbolic for Iranians for a number of reasons. First, it represents the day when the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic was forced into exile years before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. On November 4, 1964, Imam Khomeini was forced to leave Iran for Turkey after he lashed at the Pahlavi regime for giving legal immunity to the U.S. forces in Iran. Before the Islamic Revolution, thousands of U.S. soldiers and military consultants were stationed in Iran because the country was seen by the U.S. as a major bulwark against what Americans described as the threat posed by the Soviet Union. The Pahlavi regime was totally dependent on the U.S. for its security needs, and it allowed its military and security apparatus to be taken over by U.S. agents. The capitulation law was criticized as a humiliation for Iranians, and Ayatollah Khomeini was among its fiercest critics. His exile was, and still is, seen by many Iranians as the capitulation of the Shah's regime before the Americans. Ayatollah Khomeini's exile stoked anti-U.S. sentiments among Iranians. The 13th of Aban is also significant for Iranians from another perspective. Shortly after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iranian students took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran for its meddling in the affairs of Iran. The main reason behind the Students' Act was a fear from another U.S. plot against the revolution, which toppled the U.S. puppet regime in Tehran. Over the years, the U.S. has claimed that the thorny relations between Washington and Tehran is because of the U.S. embassy takeover by Iranian students. However, this is a distorted version of history presented by the U.S. establishment. In his recent remarks to Iranian students, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dismissed the U.S. assertion as a lie. Ayatollah Khamenei said that the starting point of the row goes back to the CIA-orchestrated coup of 1953. Ayatollah Khamenei was referring to the coup against the government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized Iran's oil industry. The coup, which was followed by the temporary rule of CIA and MI6-approved General Fazlullah Zahedi, enabled the monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's return from exile in Italy. It also consolidated the monarch's rule for the following 26 years, until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, led by Imam Khomeini, which toppled the Pahlavi regime.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini left Tehran for the holy city of Qom 3 weeks after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. He stayed in Qom nearly for 10 months. During this period, people would come to visit the Imam from all over the country. However, the great leader of the Islamic Revolution had to return to Tehran due to heart problem. Today, we will continue the story. Stay tuned, please. As it was said before, Imam Khomeini had to go up the steps to the roof of his house in Qom as people would gather in the alley to visit him. The Imam used to do this several times every day. Thus, he would get tired and his heart would be under pressure. Moreover, Imam Khomeini would receive a number of officials every day. This magnitude of work soon caused him heart problem in early 1980. One day his wife, Ms. Saghafi, noticed a severe pain in the Imam's shoulder and left hand, so she soon informed Haj Ahmad of the event. The Imam's special physician, Dr. Baher, asked for checking up his heart by a heart specialist. Ms. Farideh Mustafavi, the Imam's daughter, relates the story. Dr. Baher came to visit the Imam. After checking him, he said that the Imam's heart should be checked up by a specialist. Then he immediately telephoned Tehran, and a medical team was sent to Qom. When I went to the Imam's residence, I saw that Dr. Zargar, then Minister of Health, was there with a few people. Medical checkup was done, and the physicians came to the conclusion that the Imam should be checked up for a few days. Therefore, the next day, the Imam was sent to Tehran in an ambulance and was hospitalized at Tehran's Heart Hospital. The day after, my mother came to Tehran and went to his father's house. Then he went to the Imam at the hospital. The news of Imam Khomeini's hospitalization spread across the country in a few minutes. Thus, a big crowd of people gathered in the streets around the hospital. The medical team asked the people to pray for the Imam's health and immediate healing. People gradually left the area as they had become sure of his health. But the enemies spread rumors on Imam Khomeini's demise or his suffering from an incurable disease. Meanwhile, in spite of the physician's recommendation on absolute resting, the Imam delivered a very short speech, which was televised and broadcast on TV. This short speech ended all rumors of enemies. Fortunately, Imam Khomeini gained his health with the efforts of doctors and the prayers of people and left the hospital. The medical team said that the Imam should reside near the Heart Hospital to be under surveillance. Imam Khomeini accepted the recommendation, although he liked to return to Qom. Therefore, a house was determined in Darabad neighborhood of Tehran, but due to people's frequent commutation and the medical team's presence, there were disturbances for inhabitants of the place. Thus, another place was proposed for the Imam's residence. Haj Ahmad and the daughters of Imam Khomeini saw the house and accepted it as it was adjacent to a Hosseiniye, which was a suitable place for public meetings. The Hosseiniye was called Hosseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the household furniture was transferred to the new house. Hosseiniye Jamaran was half-built and it was full of construction materials, but it was completed with the people's effort within 4 days. In mid-May 1980, people decorated the street to welcome the Imam. Imam Khomeini came at 7 p.m., while a big number of people had gathered there. After entering the house and looking at the rooms, the Imam said, "Now I am comfortable, as I was under pressure for 4 months." The new house was small, but the Imam liked it. At 8 o'clock, the Imam said that he was ready to meet the people around the house. Therefore, the first public meeting was held at Hosseiniye Jamaran. A few days later, the VOA said that After a few months of searching, a place had been determined for Ayatollah Khomeini, which is immune against any air raid. The next examinations revealed that the imam's residence was suitable in terms of security, as it was beside mountains and surrounded among tall trees. Although the imam's wife would complain about the size of the rooms, the imam told her, "This is a good house. Those who come here will know that this is your house."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khomeini's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. A faith that is accompanied by wrongdoing does not bring forth safety. A faith that is not accompanied by moral duty will not grant aid to the believer. It will not guarantee his success. It will not invoke God's help and the help of the very atoms of this cosmos. It will not grant him salvation or felicity in this world and, in a word, it will not grant him paradise in the hereafter. The vain thoughts that spring from seeking a life of ease try to convince us that the opposite is true. One of the traits of the human being is that he is always looking for an easier way to do things. This state of desiring ease is something innate to humans. If you give a person a choice between two actions, all things being equal, they will choose whichever is easier, whichever requires less effort, whichever needs less investment. This is a human trait and people usually live in this manner. This is what is known as taking the path of least resistance. The easiest route. So, from this point of view, religious faith looks like it means giving up this paradise of ease. However, if we genuinely want to find ease, we should sit down and make sure we have the formula. We should sit down and make sure we have the formula right for this. The formulas that tell us that a lazy person who never does anything for anyone can go to paradise, what will it take for us to see that this cannot be right? Are we going to wait until we don't go to paradise to notice that the formula is wrong? So I am saying let's look again at the formula right now to see whether this is really going to give us the result we are after.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As well as the Quran, which is our infallible guide to the truth, there are also countless narrations from the Imams which state that their intercession cannot be attained except through striving and effort. Now, we think we can sit here despondent about our past, present and future, accept humiliation and do nothing to change our condition, and hope for intercession, even after the Imams themselves have said that their intercession is not for those who do not strive. Do you see how these narrations contradict what we imagine to be the case in our minds? One night, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam is worshipping in the mosque. He is weeping. This is someone who, according to a correct understanding of his life, was constantly striving so that truth would reign supreme. But at night, he was also constantly striving to serve God and humble himself before Him. He would cry, shed tears, and call out to his Lord. Some of his supplications are truly amazing, although now is not the time to delve into these. Then along comes a simple and naive man who says to the Imam, O son of Allah's Messenger, why do you weep? When you have such a father, such a mother, and such a grandfather, all of whom were chosen by Allah, leave weeping to us. You are the son of Allah's Messenger, the son of Ali, the son of Hussein, the son of Fatima al-Zahra. What do you have to cry for? Now Imam Zainul Abidin wants to defend the following thesis, that humbling oneself before Allah, weeping to Allah, worshipping and supplicating to Allah is to polish the soul, to make oneself more determined, to make oneself more reliant on Allah and not to slacken.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
When experts and even American citizens say democracy is under threat in the U.S., there is no exaggeration. According to Americans for Tax Fairness, billionaires have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into campaign this cycle, largely to benefit Republican candidates. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to the website of Truthout, a small group of billionaires who come from the top 0.2% of wealthiest people in the U.S. have spent nearly $900 million in the federal midterm runoffs this election cycle, a new report finds, and could reach $1 billion in political spending by the time the cycle is over. According to a report released recently by Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, just 465 American billionaires had donated an unprecedented $881 million by the end of September. even before. Last-minute campaign pushes in the last 5 weeks before Election Day. This is already more than the amount that billionaires spent in the entirety of the 2018 midterm election. Further, the vast majority of this spending, $643 million, or 73%, comes from just 20 billionaire households, including prominent figures like the Koch family, Peter Thiel, George Soros, Michael and Susan Bloomberg, and Jeffrey Yass. Of the top 10 donor families, 8 lean Republican, while 2 lean Democrat. This is a staggering amount of money spent by an astoundingly small number of people in order to influence elections that will affect the entire U.S. population and beyond. The data is a stark illustration of the vast amount of influence that billionaires have over the political system and that has been afforded to them by conservative tax cutting and Citizens United v. Federal Elections Commission, which allows billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money on elections. Indeed, as the report finds, this small group of billionaires has spent 27 times more on this election than they ever spent around 2010, when Citizens United was decided in the 2010 election cycle. For instance, billionaires spent $32 million. The majority of the $881 million spent this cycle has gone toward Republicans by a 3-2 margin, ATF finds. Democrats have received about 39% of the funding, while 59% has gone towards Republicans. The rest of the funding, 2%, has gone toward causes that most progressives oppose, like supporting Israel or cryptocurrency, ATF finds. There has also been a massive influx of fundraising for super PACs that are created for a single candidate. Such donations have risen by 150% between 2018 and this election cycle, increasing from $128 million to $223 million as of the beginning of November. About 75% of single candidate super PAC spending goes toward Republicans, the report finds. Such massive injections into elections are often more than just a political donation. They can represent huge tax savings for billionaires in the future or win them other political favors. They aren't donating to candidates because they like them. This is a transaction, wrote former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner about the report recently. Indeed, billionaires have gained trillions of dollars of wealth throughout the past few years. This growth is at least partially due to a tax code that is written to favor the rich, in part because billionaires push candidates to do so. Yes, for instance, has dodged $1 billion in taxes over the past 6 years, while billionaire donor Ken Griffin spent $54 million to shut down a tax-raising initiative, a move that is now saving him tens of millions of dollars in taxes each year. Newly uncovered emails from key figures on former President Donald Trump's legal team show that his lawyers viewed embattled Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas as a powerful secret weapon and perhaps their only influential legal ally in their plan to overturn the 2020 election, according to an email exchange from December 2020 obtained by congressional investigators and reported by Politico. At least two lawyers on Trump's legal team believed that Thomas was their only chance to legally challenge the results of the election before the election certification date rolled around. We want to frame things so that Thomas could be the one to issue some sort of a stay or other circuit justice opinion saying Georgia is in legitimate doubt. Trump attorney Kenneth Chesebro wrote in an email addressed to Trump's legal team on December 31, 2020. Realistically, our only chance to get a favorable judicial opinion by January 6, which might hold up the Georgia count in Congress, is from Thomas. Do you agree, Professor John Eastman? I think I agree with this, replied Eastman, a Trump lawyer who was key in crafting the plan to overturn the election. If the court were to give us key, that might be enough to kick the Georgia legislature into gear, because I have been getting a lot of calls from them indicating to me they are leaning that way, he said. Around the same time as the Thomas emails, Trump's lawyers were scrambling to get the then president to sign onto documents that they worried had voter fraud statistics that could invite legal trouble for him down the line. I have no doubt that aggressive DA or U.S. attorney someplace will go after both the president and his lawyers once all the dust settles on this, Eastman wrote on two other Trump lawyers. They ended up removing the figures, which led them to another problem. They were facing a tight deadline, but Trump was on a plane without access to a notary. There is no one they can call to come to the White House that's a notary, one GOP tied attorney wrote, adding, I don't know how we file without it. Presidential trip to a UPS store? They ultimately got a White House clerk to attest to the document signing, which ended up being key to the federal judge's decision to order Eastman to turn over the emails. The emails, the judge wrote, show that President Trump knew that specific numbers of voter fraud were wrong, but continued to tout those numbers both in court and to the public. And that is why experts and even American citizens say democracy is under threat in the U.S., and this is no exaggeration.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran has unveiled the Bavar 373 missile system with a range of over 300 kilometers. Moreover, the Sayyad B-4 defense missile production line was also inaugurated on Sunday in a ceremony attended by Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at the range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at the range of more than 300 kilometers.
Bavar 373 missile system has successfully hit targets at a range of 305 kilometers. This missile system has been designed to counter long-range targets, ballistic missiles, warplanes, and bombers. Even many technologically advanced countries aspire to have such a high-tech missile system.
The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers.
The missile system has been totally produced and upgraded by Iranian specialists at the Defense Ministry and the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have been able to upgrade the range of this missile in only 2 years. This shows that we can counter all kinds of threats by using domestically made defensive equipment. As much as the threats advance, the Bavar 373 system and other air defense systems advance ahead of their current threats.
The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers,